AR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program today, we'll look back at the covert wars in Afghanistan that helped fuel Islamic militancy, and we'll talk about the state of American intelligence then and now. Our guest is journalist Steve Call. Call is the author of Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, from the Soviet invasion to September 10th, 2001. Steve Call has won the 2005 Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction for Ghost Wars. The award was announced yesterday. It is the second Pulitzer Prize for the Washington Post editor. He won the Pulitzer in 1990 for explanatory journalism. Steve Call was the paper's South Asia bureau chief between 1989 and 1992. The author of four books, his latest Ghost Wars, has just recently been published in paperback in an updated version with documents from the 9/11 Commission. Listeners, I welcome your telephone calls this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments for Steve Call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Steve Call, welcome. Congratulations.
Well, thank you, Celeste. I'm glad to be with you.
Sure, my pleasure to speak with you. The ghosts of the title comes from what Soviet soldiers called the CIA-supplied Afghan rebels in the 1980s, the Soviet word for ghosts. And at the close of your prologue, you say, the Soviets could never quite grasp and hold their enemy. Would you give us some sense of the ghosts who operated in Afghanistan from the Soviet invasion in 79 through the summer of 2001?
Well, that 20-year war, which had many phases and many players, was characterized, I think, to an unusual degree by irregular forces and intelligence services interfering, shaping, seeking to promote different factions in the theater of war. And from the point of view of trying to understand American engagements with Afghanistan during this period, of course, the CIA, to an unusual degree in American history, was the lead agency in Afghanistan, because they were sent over during the 1980s to shape the secret anti-Soviet Mujahideen rebel force that the United States had decided to help because it would challenge the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. And then later in the 1990s, in the toward the end of the 1990s, the CIA came back again as the sort of lead instrument of American policy in Afghanistan, this time on a counterterrorism mission to try to chase Osama bin Laden. And, of course, it wasn't just the American intelligence service that was so prominently involved in Afghanistan's wars. It was also the Pakistan intelligence service, known as ISI, really thought of as a division of their army, and the Saudi intelligence service, and of course during the 80s on the Soviet side, the KGB was involved as well. So, from a researcher's point of view, trying to trace the antecedents of a surprise attack like 9/11, a challenge of this history, unique among the histories of such that preceded such surprise attacks, was that all of this activity was being shaped by secret services. So the record was also secret.
Yeah. Can you give us some sense of how you track down this story or stories that unfold in Ghost Wars?
Well, by every means possible. I was, of course, a journalist who had worked out there during several years of this story, and I had a head start in the sense that I had worked on it intensively on in the theater itself. I'd been in Afghanistan a lot. I'd been in Pakistan a lot. I'd become very interested in, as a Washington Post correspondent, in American policy and understood that that was primarily a CIA-driven policy. And so I had done a lot of reporting about how that system worked and what kinds of policy debates surrounded it. After September 11th, with the basis of that sort of experience and lots of archives that I'd been carrying around over the years trying to figure out what to do with, I thought that I should go back and attack this history more fully. And so I tried to both use interviewing as a way to tease out the details of how these Secret Services had operated, and I was determined to do that from as many points of view as I could. So I interviewed not just on the American side, but also the Pakistani side and the Saudi side and the Afghan side. And by sort of circling around that way, I was able to pull out bits and pieces and carry them across and enhance my understanding. And then, in addition to interviewing, I tried to rely as fully as I could on documentation. That proved much easier when I was concerned with the 1980s than it was when I got closer to September 11th, where the material was more sensitive and more politicized.
Yeah. I would imagine it would be very tough to do this kind of reporting today.
About current events, yes. Yeah. Well, it's always very difficult to report accurately about sort of the activities of Secret Services, especially the nearer you are to the events, the harder it is to do. But in our system, the American sort of system, still, it's not impossible, and it's important, I think, for journalists, news organizations to try, even when it's frustrating.
When the Soviets left Afghanistan, the U.S. left as well and didn't return, as you just said a moment or two ago, until the late 1990s. At that time, did anyone realize what that abandonment would mean in the years to come?
Yes, I think to a significant degree, there were Americans involved in U.S. policy toward Afghanistan who recognized that the vacuum that would be created by an American decision to withdraw could become quite dangerous. There weren't too many people who could foresee the idea of an organization like Al-Qaeda crossing oceans and attacking on American soil, but there were warnings that Afghanistan would become a fulcrum of regional terrorism, of radical Sunni Islamic violence of the sort that Al-Qaeda was already beginning to promote, that it would become a multinational source of instability. And the warnings were quite specific about this inside the U.S. National Security bureaucracy. For instance, there was a fear that as the Soviet Union dissolved and its successor states in Central Asia, which were heavily Islamic in their populations, as they became independent, that an unstable Afghanistan dominated by violent radicals would make it difficult for those countries to sort of develop and stabilize, and that proved accurate along with other forecasts.
Why did the U.S. opt out of getting involved in rebuilding Afghanistan?
Well, it was a decision ultimately, I think, made as much out of indifference as out of deliberation, which is one of the sort of sad aspects of the record when you look back on it. There was a vigorous debate that unfolded between about 1988 and roughly 1992 within the national security bureaucracy about whether the United States had sufficient interests in Afghanistan to warrant the risks and considerable uncertainties of attempting to build centrist stable politics there and to reconstruct the country from the physical rubble that it had been reduced to as a result of the Soviet war. And the debate sort of sounded like this. On one side, you had people saying a vacuum would be dangerous. We have a moral obligation to Afghans who fought so hard on our behalf in the Cold War context. This is an achievable project, some argued, but it will require some money and some political commitment, some sustained political commitment. On the other side, you had people arguing, mainly at the CIA, but not only there, that this was a fool's errand, that, first of all, the United States could not fix Afghanistan, and secondly, we had no interest in attempting this difficult project, that we should recognized that we were in Afghanistan in the first place for one reason, which was to challenge the Soviet Union. We'd succeeded with that, and we should go home as they went home. And this debate raged at the middle levels of the bureaucracy. Maybe raged is too strong a word, but it certainly at times was quite heated. And it was never really resolved. What happened was that the time passed, the Berlin Wall fell, the Soviet Union collapsed, and by the time you got to the beginning of the Clinton administration, Afghanistan as an issue had just slipped so far down the list that it really wasn't anybody's priority except those down in the career foreign service or intelligence services who dealt with the place.
Yeah, it was the last war of the Cold War, and the Cold War was over.
Yes, yeah. And for the Clinton people, it was sort of, well, that's where the Reagan people made their stand. That's not our territory. The Clinton folks were very interested in areas that they felt had been neglected by the Republicans who had preceded them, such as Africa. And so they didn't have a lot of folks coming into their administration who had any personal experience of Afghanistan or any commitment to its reconstruction. And in fairness, rebuilding Afghanistan in the early 1990s, establishing stable politics, would have been a very difficult project, in part because our notional, sometime mutually suspicious ally, Pakistan, had a different plan in mind, which was to try to establish a friendly government in Kabul by force. And so they were undermining attempts that were underway by the UN and the Europeans and others to stabilize Afghanistan in the early 90s.
How was the Taliban able to rise from a small group of religious militants into the force it became?
I don't think it's possible to understand the Taliban's claims on national power in Afghanistan as against regional power in the south, where they were born, as you say, as a small group. I don't think it's possible to understand their claims on national power without understanding that they were essentially a clandestine instrument of the Pakistan Army. Pakistan Army had sought over a long period of time to control its unruly neighbor Afghanistan on its western border, to prevent Afghanistan from destabilizing Pakistan, and to prevent it from becoming a platform for Indian mischief, as the Pakistan Army would have thought of it. And so they sought to establish in Kabul a government dominated by political Islam that would be friendly to Pakistan's interests. And the Taliban were an instrument of this long-running and oft-failed policy pursued by the Pakistan Army. And so when they began to surface in the south in 1994, the Pakistan Army started secretly supplying them with weapons and support and even personnel to help them take control of more and more territory. And by the fall of 1996, they'd more or less succeeded as Kabul fell to the Taliban.
Hmm. Were there efforts on the part of the U.S. and or Europe to engage the Taliban, to engage Pakistan, to get the Taliban and Pakistan to cooperate against Osama bin Laden?
Well, yes, there was this sort of question that was always kind of hanging over everybody's engagements with Afghanistan after the Taliban became a national force, which was, who are the Taliban? Are they an adversary of the West? Are they a force that could potentially be separated from bin Laden and al-Qaeda and sort of used to isolate bin Laden or even to expel bin Laden and turn him over to a court in the United States or something of that sort? And the Pakistanis, who desperately wanted the Taliban to be recognized as a legitimate government of Afghanistan, along with the Saudis, who had the same goal, repeatedly argued to the United States and to the Europeans, look, give the Taliban a chance. They're not as radical as you think they are. They're a little bit naive. They're politically young. Give them time. They'll moderate. They'll mature. If you offer them incentives to join the international community and follow its norms, they'll respond to those incentives. So there were a number of people in the United States government who really accepted this hypothesis, and so they kept reaching out to the Taliban, seeking to negotiate with them, seeking to persuade them to change their accommodation of Osama bin Laden, for instance. And this proved to be a doomed mission, because, in fact, it turned out that the Taliban's leadership, anyway, its senior leadership, was really totalitarian in outlook and not prepared to modernize or moderate its policies.
Yeah. Well, you report that by the close of the year 2000, the Clinton administration felt any hopes for cooperation against bin Laden were absurd. Was there a discussion of military intervention at that time?
There was discussion about it. Beginning in 1997, early 1998, President Clinton authorized the CIA to develop clandestine agents and militia forces that might be able to either capture bin Laden and a small group of al-Qaeda leaders around him and bring them to trial, or perhaps even kill them in the process of attempting to make an arrest. And so the CIA began this endeavor and started to recruit agents for that purpose, and they had a few near misses. At the same time, when the CIA struggled to sort of get the job done, Clinton turned to the Pentagon on the military side, the formal military side, and began to inquire of them whether they could organize a special forces raid of some sort that might succeed where the less well-trained agents of the CIA were struggling. And the Pentagon's view was that this was just too difficult to pull off in Afghanistan, that when they made their proposals to Clinton about this possibility, they emphasized the need for a very, very large force. And from the Clinton administration's point of view, from the White House folks who received these briefings from the Pentagon, they sort of thought the Pentagon was deliberately inflating the size of the required force so as to make it very difficult for Clinton to order them to do it. In any event, this turned out to be a kind of a stalemate, and the Pentagon never was seriously involved in chasing after bin Laden before September 11th.
Was there much debate within the Clinton administration over how to get at bin Laden?
Yes, both sort of operationally in the sense of should we pull the trigger today? Because after, you remember, bin Laden hit the two U.S. embassies in Africa in August of 1998. That announced quite clearly that he intended violence against American targets where he could reach them, and that he was very well organized, and that the sanctuary that he enjoyed in Afghanistan was allowing him to undertake pretty ambitious operations. So Clinton ordered, you'll remember that Clinton retaliated or struck immediately after those embassy bombings by sending some cruise missiles to a camp where the CIA believed bin Laden might be attending a leadership meeting. Whether he was ever there isn't entirely certain. There's some suggestion that he may have been tipped off while the missiles were in the air. In any event, they missed him. They killed some of his low-level followers. And in the aftermath of that failed strike, Clinton was cautioned by the political reaction, which basically denounced him for attempting to distract attention from his problems with Monica Lewinsky by sending cruise missiles out of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But he was also still attentive to the possibility of killing bin Laden, so he stationed some submarines secretly off the coast of Pakistan that were loaded with cruise missiles. And the missiles could reach targets in most of Afghanistan within about 6 hours of a presidential order. And so he asked the CIA to sort of see if they could locate bin Laden reliably enough to permit him to shoot the missiles. And a couple of times, the CIA reported on bin Laden's location, and there was a debate within the Clinton administration about whether to shoot. So that was one set of debates. The second set of debates involved whether or not to get more deeply involved in Afghanistan's civil war for the purpose of finding, killing, capturing bin Laden and destroying al-Qaeda. And this would have involved collaborating with the Northern Alliance, which was led by Ahmad Shah Massoud, a very charismatic guerrilla commander in northern Afghanistan. And there were some at the CIA who argued that the United States really did need to choose sides against the Taliban, against bin Laden, and to really support Massoud, who they regarded as a nationalist and a potential Democrat. And there were others who argued that Massoud would be a bad partner, that he was part of the failed warlordism of the past, And again, as in the earlier debate we talked about, this debate about whether to choose sides in the Afghan war and to really line up against the Taliban was never really resolved. It was just sort of argued to an impasse. And so American policy was shaped as much by passivity as by decision-making.
And that failure to build something with Massoud was one of the opportunities, you say, the U.S. missed on the way to September 11th.
Yeah, I think that's what the record tells us. And it's not clear. People ask and speculate even today, well, what difference might it have made from if you're asking how might history have changed, how might the specific, spectacular, disruptive, world-changing attack of September 11th, how might that plot have been prevented? And I think that, of course, in the end, all we can do is speculate about questions like that. But if you wish to indulge a little informed speculation, I would say that Al-Qaeda metastasized over these years from 1997 to 2001. In the earlier, the United States might have acted against its leadership and against the sanctuary that it enjoyed, the more difference it would have made. We know that the Hamburg cell, for instance, didn't show up in Afghanistan until November of 1999. They didn't really get their marching orders until early the next year. So if the United States had chosen to act decisively and to recognize the Afghan context in which bin Laden thrived in 98 or 99, it might well have made a difference. By the summer of 2001, even the decapitation of Al-Qaeda leadership might not have prevented 9/11.
Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, journalist Steve Call, winner of the 2005 Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction for his book Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden from the Soviet Invasion to September 10, 2001. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with your questions. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our first caller this afternoon waiting on the toll-free line in Eureka, Line 4. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I guess a question that always goes through my mind when Afghanistan and bin Laden are discussed is what connections did he have with the CIA, whether they were direct, indirect, or kind of at a distance? And I wonder what would your guest opinion be for the evidence for or against that?
Yeah, it's a good question. The record, which I have scrutinized very thoroughly on this question, the record indicates that there was no direct contact between CIA officers working on the Afghan program and Osama bin Laden, but there was certainly indirect collaboration that helped to create the context in which bin Laden thrived. First, there was the relationship between the CIA and Saudi intelligence, which was quite close during the 1980s and early 1990s. As bin Laden was rising on the Afghan frontier, the Saudis matched dollar-for-dollar secret American allocations to the war, which totaled hundreds of millions of dollars allocated by the U.S. Congress each year by the late 1980s. Bin Laden worked quite closely with Saudi intelligence. He was well-known to the royal family, and Prince Turki, who ran Saudi intelligence, has said publicly that he met Osama five times at least when he was visiting Pakistan. In addition, my research shows contacts between Prince Turki's chief of staff, a guy named Ahmed Badib, and bin Laden during the same period. And Badib was more of an operator who would have collaborated with Osama on the frontier. So there was a kind of an alliance, an alliance of interests and indirect collaboration. And a lot of the resources that the United States was pouring up to the area where bin Laden was building the seed that became al-Qaeda, a lot of that was funneled through Pakistani intelligence. And they also had contacts with bin Laden, very direct contacts with him. They worked with Osama to build logistical facilities along the frontier, the famous caves, and other things that Americans heard about in the fall of 2001. Just one other point on this. Even after the Soviets left and the United States and the CIA sort of withdrew from collaboration with the Pakistan Army on Afghanistan, the Pakistanis continued to work with bin Laden because they thought that they could take the lessons of the anti-Soviet jihad and use them against India in Kashmir. So they used bin Laden's and al-Qaeda's training camps as a way to train and motivate guerrillas that they then sent across to Kashmir. I wouldn't suggest that the Pakistan Army sanctioned or endorsed or worked with bin Laden on his attacks against American targets, but they did work with him in a sort of day-to-day way to try to get guerrillas across to Kashmir.
I want to thank the listener for his call. Let's take another call. Champaign County, Line 1. Good afternoon.
Hi. I wanted to ask about the way you framed your book title, which is Brzezinski is pretty tantamount to admitted that there was CIA involvement in Afghanistan prior to the invasion, and that it was actually calculated to destabilize and provoke and to sort of elicit the invasion so they could have their Vietnam. Now, there's some people that will say, well, they just took advantage of the situation, but, I mean, there are quite a few people that have a different understanding and realize that the U.S. was there before the invasion. Well, how do you stand on that?
Well, I think that the details matter here, and the details are ambiguous enough so that people can offer their own interpretations, but I'll tell you what the facts are and also then how I interpret them. The United States did talk about covert action and covert aid to the Afghan rebels before the Soviet invasion. That's because the Soviet-sponsored government in Afghanistan was crumbling and facing rebellion from a broad swath of Afghan society about 6 to 9 months before the invasion occurred. The United States noted this rebellion developing in a communist country where the Soviets had made heavy investments of aid, and they met in the White House under Brzezinski's leadership to say, well, what should we do about it? Should we help these rebels to embarrass the Soviets? The record shows that they debated that question without acting for about 4 or 5 months, and then in July of 1979, about 5 or 6 months before the Soviet invasion, they approved a small dose of non-lethal aid to the Afghan rebels, essentially radio sets and to help them communicate better, and some medical equipment to help them with their wounded. So it was a kind of a symbolic gesture. Now, Brzezinski has said, as the caller points out, in interviews given very recently after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that he intended this aid to provoke the Soviets into a trap, in effect. Now, I just don't see in the record of Brzezinski's contemporaneous writings and his memos to the president any evidence to support that view. It feels imposed on the past to me. What's interesting, and it's all to Brzezinski, I'm not criticizing Brzezinski's role or suggesting that he wasn't farsighted about this, but if you go back and look at what he actually wrote to President Carter before and after the Soviet invasion, I don't see any evidence for his subsequent claims about having trapped the Soviets. There's no glee in his voice at all. What there is a really fascinating memo that he wrote to Carter shortly after Christmas in 1979, just after the Soviets invaded, in which he meditates on the possibility that this could be a Soviet Vietnam. And he does see, quite farsightedly and very articulately, that the Soviets have made a terrible mistake by invading, that they are going to ruin their reputation in the developing world, that they've made themselves vulnerable militarily, and that this is a rare opening for the United States in the broad contest of the Cold War to really rack the Soviets around. And so he does outline the policy of secret aid to the rebels there. But as to this idea that he had induced the Soviets in, I think the memo belies that, because it says, look, this could be a disaster for us, too. This is unwelcome. They may win. It's not a confident-sounding document. So, I just sort of feel like...
Can I get in?
Yeah, go ahead. Follow up.
The point I would like to make is that you're looking at the written memo. In fact, I thought of this when you were talking about the CIA's involvement with bin Laden. I mean, how much of that could have been verbal on the ground and not documented? If Brzezinski was suspicious of it being a problem, he wouldn't exult in it, and he would leave a memo that would perhaps point the other way, so it was ambiguous, and so that people would focus less on the idea that was provoked. So, basically, I'm just wondering in your methodology of looking at the written record from the CIA, can you also account for the fact that a lot of stuff goes on sub rosa? And
right. Well, and, you can spin conspiracy theories about anything, and I don't discount your argument in this case. I think it, it's a fair question to ask in this case. But I'm an empiricist. I'm interested in oral, accounts too. Of course, I'm not saying that, but I just think that written records are generally more reliable than people's recollections 20 years after the fact. I think you'd have to agree that just as an empirical matter, generally contemporaneous written records are better. Doesn't mean they're flawless. Doesn't mean they can't
be
mislead. It might in this case, but you asked my interpretation of the record. I'm telling you what it is, and I also am telling you what the record is, and there's not a lot of evidence to support what Brzezinski says. On the question of contacts with Osama, I think there I'm more skeptical about what the record shows us, that there wasn't direct contact. I'm quite open to the possibility that there was direct contact. I just haven't been able to discover it, and I note that a number of people who would have gone to jail if it could be proved otherwise have raised their hands under oath and sworn that it didn't happen. That doesn't mean that they aren't lying and they aren't risking jail by doing so. But I push very hard on that. I'm still working on it in some broad sort of sense of always being a journalist, but neither I nor anyone else who's pushed at it has yet been able to find evidence of such contacts.
I thank the listener for his call. I've got some other folks waiting to talk with our guest, Steve Call, this afternoon. So next we go to a caller in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hello, yes. Mr. Call, your book is a very fascinating book, and I hope you don't mind if I say that it reads more like a Tom Clancy thriller. Hello?
Yes, as long as you don't mean it as fiction.
that's what I'm saying. It is actually, it is really, a very thrilling book. Now, I have a couple of questions regarding, Pakistan and what is happening now. So do you see some kind of similarity between Pakistan then and Pakistan now? A similar kind of attack had taken place last year where some American diplomatic personnel were either killed or maimed. And also the common Pakistanis, not the English-speaking elite, but those who live hand-to-mouth, they were under a military dictator who usurped power through a coup, which is not unlike the situation today.
Yes.
No. And the second question is, in light of the above, what are your views on selling or more like donating nuclear weapon delivery capable advanced warplanes to Pakistan? Is it to keep India down, which could be a potential future competitor of U.S.?
Both good questions. There are a lot of parallels between the relationship between the United States and Pakistan today and the relationship that's described in the history, the years that Ghost Wars tries to wrestle with. And there are also some important differences. I think that both sides mistrust one another. That was true in the past, and it's true today. It's not just that the United States mistrusts the Pakistan Army, it's also that the Pakistan Army regards the United States as an unreliable ally based on its reading of the history. So this is a collaboration that occurs at arm's length even today.
Mm-hmm.
If there is concern about the stability of the Pakistan Army, the extent to which it's prepared to forswear jihad as an instrument of statecraft and other sort of concerns that the United States have, not to even mention nuclear proliferation and the Khan network, mm-hmm. then why would the United States sell F-16s to the Pakistan Army, to go to your second question?
Yeah.
You can interpret it as a sort of venal sort of appeasement of the Pakistan Army, not terribly well thought through. But I think that actually what's going on here is something a little subtler and a little harder to see, which is I think that that the United States and India are engaged in a new and much more confident and important strategic partnership than they've ever attempted to build together before. Mm-hmm. That both governments recognize that this is a natural partnership between democracies with large populations and great economic potential, that it was a missed opportunity to have not started to build this strategic partnership in the past, and that there is a common interest in doing so now. And at the heart of that partnership, though, lies the unresolved problem of Pakistan. India and the United States, I think, both recognize that a modernizing, stable, secularizing Pakistan is in both their national interests. So then the question becomes, how do you achieve such a thing?
No, one small, I mean, I want to take exception to that particular point of view. It is possible that a broken up Pakistan into Balochistan, Sindh, and Punjab would be more in the interest of the entire that region. In fact, just like the Russia was, I mean, the FSU was broken up.
Well, I mean, that's a provocative, even radical point of view that I'm sure is occasionally contemplated and discussed. But it would be you'd have to pay a very heavy price to achieve such a thing. Now, you know, there may come a time if Pakistan's army falls apart, if there is a loss of control over Pakistan's nuclear weapons, if the unthinkable occurs, if there's a nuclear detonation caused by Pakistan's government in South Asia or a nuclear detonation caused by Pakistan's government in the West, where Pakistan will cease to exist as a nation, it will be broken up into a vassal state managed by India and so forth, and then India will have to cope with a long period of insurgencies and economic problems and violence. And I think that what I'm saying is that while, yes, there are alternative scenarios, the United States and India today, their governments actually, I think, both believe that if it's possible to achieve a modernizing, stabilizing, secularizing Pakistan, which is not a certainty, but if it's possible to achieve, that it's worth some creative collaboration. And in order to achieve that, they both believe, you have to have the Pakistan army in the equation, because there is no other Pakistan without the army as part of the equation. And so the United States has convinced itself that persuading the Pakistan army that it ought to become a part of this partnership, moderate its policies, stay close to the United States, seek peace with India, that to do that, the F-16s is a symbolic gesture to demonstrate that the United States is serious about its part in this. Now, you know, that's all I'm trying to say is that's why this sale was sanctioned. I'm not suggesting that it was the right decision, but it's not a blind sort of appeasement of the Pakistan Army's shopping list. It's an attempt with full collaboration by India, whose expressions of disappointment about the sale, I think, are somewhat sort of stage-managed. It's an attempt to try to build a stable Pakistan.
I want to thank the listener for his call. Let's go and talk with another caller, a listener in Champaign, line 3. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm sure you're right that Brzezinski may have been lying at one time or another, but what he actually said, and I'm quoting here, was on 3rd July 1979, President Carter signed the first directive for secret aid to the opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul. On that same day, I wrote a note to the president in which I explained that, in my opinion, this aid would lead to a Soviet military intervention. And Robert Gates' memoirs suggested or makes it clear that they were indeed doing that, that is, they were sending aid to the guerrillas 6 months before the Soviet invasion. So the notion that they backed into it seems to me to be not quite right, even if Brzezinski was enhancing his role later. It's clear that the U.S. did what it did in order to provoke that invasion.
Mm. Yeah, maybe. I've never seen that note. I've only seen Brzezinski's characterization of it.
Actually, that note's quoted in... you've never seen the note that he said he wrote?
Yes.
Yeah, I see. Uh-huh. Yeah.
He's characterizing the note again 20 years after the fact. And I'm also saying that if you went back and you looked at all of the records of the debates from 1979, everything that's available anyway... including what Brzezinski wrote at the time. I don't know, it's just hard for me to interpret that record the way Brzezinski interpreted it 20 years later. Maybe you would read it and look at all the detailed memos that he wrote and come to a different conclusion. But my two cents is to urge skepticism about Brzezinski's emphasis on this trap hypothesis. It just, to me, I don't know, it might have been something that he contemplated at times. I'm not suggesting that he never entertain the idea, but to position it as the sort of basic theory of his policy, my own interpretation of the record is it's just not supported. But Others can go back and review the details and argue otherwise.
What do you do with the suggestion that this most expensive CIA operation in history, in which the CIA went out and found the most savage and fanatic religious fighters it could, the sources of Al-Qaeda, actually kept the Russians in Afghanistan longer than they would have been there had the U.S. not been busily putting this group together?
Well, I think that's probably right. That involves the history that unfolds after the Soviet occupation. It's right because the Soviet, I think it's probably right because the Soviet records suggest in the early 80s that they wanted out as fast as they could get out, and that they were embarking on a program not unlike the one that we're embarking on now in Iraq, which was an attempt to sort of Afghanize the counterinsurgency, build up credible Afghan national forces, and get the 40th Army out. And this failed for a lot of reasons, but that included the fierceness of the Afghan resistance supported by the United States. Now, you know, there's embedded in your good question is a debate that was never really resolved throughout the 1980s, which was whether or not the Afghan resistance would have been as broadly based and as fierce as it was without the radical Islamic political leadership that the Pakistan Intelligence Service in particular promoted with increasing insistence during the 1980s. There were a lot of people, certainly Pakistan Intelligence Service among them, and some of their collaborators at the CIA, who said, look, these are the only guys who really want to fight to the death. We need to make them better endowed than their rivals, more moderate rivals in the Afghan resistance, because they're the ones that make the Soviets bleed. You can make that case, but there were a lot of others who would argue that the Afghan resistance was really very broadly based from the beginning, and it was fierce across the board. If you look at the uprisings in Herat and in the south, which were not led by the most radical Islamists, those were pretty determined guerrilla groups as well. And it may be that the Pakistan Army's insistence on promoting the radicals became a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy because they gave them the most guns and money, therefore they were the most effective militarily.
Let's see if we can get one more call in this afternoon on line one. A listener in Urbana. Hi.
You must be short of time.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, two things then, and I'll hang up. One is that I noticed the Guardian newspaper faults your book for, and you were talking earlier about all the thinking about the Taliban and for not mentioning drugs at all, the drug trade. And it seemed to me that a more accurate account would have to find some way of weaving that into the whole, what you had said before. And then number two, I understood that your book, in terms of this Brzezinski thing, your book does seem to believe that the Pakistan's nuclear program was kind of or allowed by Brzezinski and Carter, because they understood that after the Russians invaded Afghanistan, they had to have a different attitude toward Pakistan, and one of the primary things that they were going to give up was their stubbornness about the non-proliferation policy. And I guess I'll let you talk about those. I'll hang up.
Yeah, thanks. That's right in summary about the nuclear program. The Carter administration had brought relations with Pakistan to a very low ebb right before the Soviet invasion, which is, not to keep re-arguing this point, but another reason to wonder why Brzezinski would have permitted that if he was so focused on the Afghan war. But in any event, after the Soviet invasion, they did begin to adopt a much more passive view about the Pakistan Army's nuclear ambitions. On the drugs thing, it's true that in making choices about what to emphasize in the history, I did not write, except in passing, about Pakistan's and Afghanistan's sort of shared drug economy. I think the only thing I think that was probably just a flaw of mine. I just had so many things I had to decide what to put in, what to take out. I probably should have put more in. But what I know about it is that the best way to think about Afghanistan's, what I believe is that the best way to think about Afghanistan's drug economy is not to leave Pakistan out of it, because most of the heroin that gets manufactured off of Afghan poppies, which are after all grown by poor subsistence farmers who are not themselves involved generally in militia activity, most of the heroin is manufactured along the border on the Pakistan side in the same areas where bin Laden is presumed to be hiding today. And it speaks to the sort of transnational criminalization that the heroin economy in the region creates. And it's as much a Pakistan issue as it is an Afghan issue.
I want to thank the listener for his call. Before we go, I do want to ask you, Steve, no attacks on U.S. soil since September 11th, but there have been attacks elsewhere in the world. Are we safer? What's the status of the jihadi movement today?
Well, I think the organization, the al-Qaeda organization that carried out the September 11th attacks, which enjoyed sanctuary in Afghanistan and had leadership that was unmolested and management committees and training camps and global recruitment, that organization essentially no longer exists. It's been destroyed or substantially degraded. But unfortunately, al-Qaeda has morphed into a movement. It's no longer an organization, but it's now a global movement. And the ideology that bin Laden espouses still in exile resonates with jihad-minded guerrilla groups from Morocco to Indonesia. And it's created a pattern of spontaneously forming cells and groups affiliated with bin Laden's goal of mass casualty attacks. Iraq is one theater where this has occurred. It's also occurred, obviously, in lots of other places abroad where we've seen attacks. Why have there been no attacks inside the United States? I think it's a bit of a mystery. In some ways, al-Qaeda's pattern is that it doesn't really like to attack hard targets. It likes soft targets. They clearly did not have sleeper cells inside the United States after 9/11, as the FBI advised the president they did, or at least the sleeper cells were not very capable. They also haven't been able as yet to stimulate spontaneous affiliation with al-Qaeda among disaffected American residents, whether they're Muslims or otherwise. And so that's been the pattern where they've been able to create attacks abroad, but they haven't been able to pull it off in the United States. But that's sort of the story to date, and I think the movement is still very much alive.
Yeah. There we have to leave it, I'm sorry to say. Many more questions left here on the table this afternoon. Steve Call, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Glad to be with you, Celeste. Thank you.
Steve Call, our guest this afternoon here on this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, winner of the 2005 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction for his book Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden from the Soviet Invasion to September 10, 2001. The book now available in paperback from Penguin. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock, let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. Well, soy meal basis firmed up a little bit today, including in Danville, Illinois, where we saw a change of $1. That, in turn, fueled soy futures on the Chicago Board of Trade. They finished firmer on the day, in a day which saw wheat as well as corn finished to the downside, moving through several levels of support. We'll talk about those in just a few minutes with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana, that at the closing market report at 206. Let's go ahead and get you caught up on the particulars in the settlement prices. May wheat, a high on the day of 317 and a half, a low of 310 and a half. Settling 311 and a quarter, down 5 and a quarter. July, a high of 326 and a half, a low of 320. Settling 321 and a quarter, down 4. September, a high of 332 and three quarters, a low of 327. Settling on the low, down 5 on the day. December, a high of 342 and a quarter, a low of 335. Settling 335 and a quarter, down 5. March, a high of 349, a low of 344. Settling on the low, down 4 on the day. May corn, a high of 208, a low of 205 and a quarter, settling 205 and a half, down 4 and a quarter. Along the way, breaking through support levels at 209 and 206. July corn, a high on the day of 216 and a half, a low of 213 and a half, settling 213.75, down 4.25. September, a high of 241.25, low of 221, settling 221.5, down 4.25. December, a high of 233.5, a low of 230, settling 230.5, down 4.5. March corn, a high of 239.75, a low of 236.5, settling 237, down 4.25. May, a high of 243.25, a low of 240.25, settling on the low, down 4.5 on the day. May oats, a high of 156.25, a low of 152.5, settling 153, down 2.25. July, a high of 153.25, a low of 150.5, settling 151.25, down 1.25. May beans, a high of 623, a low of 608, settling 617.5, up 2.5. July, a high of 628.5, a low of 614, settling 624.75, up 2.75. August, a high of 627, a low of 612.5, settling 623.75, up 5.25 on the day. September, a high of 615, a low of 603, settling 611.75, up 4.75. November, a high of 609, a low of 596, settling 606.25, up 4.75. January, a high of 610, a low of 599, settling 608.75, up 6.75 on the day. There was also market talk that a few crushers in Illinois and Indiana will take some downtime this month for seasonal maintenance. That also giving some support to credences of a higher soy meal market. Let's go ahead and look there. High on the day of 186 in the May contract, a low of 181.30, settling 184.10, up 90. July, a high of 188, a low of 183, settling 186.20, up 110. May soybean oil, a high of 22.99, a low of 22.69, settling 22.82, up 2. July, a high of 23.17, a low of 22.86, settling 23 even, down 6 on the day. Settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where a decision tomorrow, a federal decision tomorrow, Celeste pressured the lean hog futures downward. We'll have more about that on the closing market report as well.
Okay, cattle were higher today. April feeder cattle, 109.20 the high, 108.55 the low, 108.80 the settlement, that up 2.5. May, 105.80 the high, 105.05 the low, finishing at 105.67.5, up 37.5. August feeders, 107.60 the high, 106.85 the low. The settlement, 107.52.5, that down 2.5. April live cattle, 89 even the high, 88.35 the low, 88.95 the settlement, that up 17.5. June, 84.50 the high, 83.65 the low, 84.47.5 the settlement, that up 35. April lean hog, 69.55 the high, 68.40 the low, 68.67.5 the settlement, that down 87.5. May, 77.70 the high, 75.92.5 the low, the settlement 76.22.5, that down 170. June lean hogs, 80.10 the high, 78.07.5 the low, the settlement 78.22.5, that down 162.5. July, 79.55 the high, 78.05 the low, 78.27.5 the settlement, that down 115. May bellies, 94.35 the high, 92.80 the low, 93.40 the settlement.